Hey everyone, you're listening to Sustainable Nano. I'm your host, Miriam Krause, and today on the podcast, we have what I hope will be the first in a series of book review episodes, where I chat with a colleague from the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology about a book that they recently read that we think would be of interest to you listeners. So for this first book review, we are talking about a book that came out earlier this year by Sean Otto called The War on Science: Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. I want to point out that we recorded this conversation actually quite a while ago, well before the US election, and you'll hear that we try to make it clear pretty early on, it's not intended as any kind of one-sided political statement. There's a risk in our current climate here that any discussion that relates to policy or politics or even science can be perceived as partisan, and we're going to try really hard to avoid that here on Sustainable Nano, but we don't want to avoid it so rigorously that we fail to address these topics altogether, because that doesn't help anybody. So, I usually put our disclaimer at the end of the podcast, but just to be on the safe side, I'm going to say it right up front today. The views that are expressed here on our podcast are those of the individuals speaking and do not represent those of our funding agency, the National Science Foundation. I hope that you will find this conversation interesting regardless of your political leanings, and we certainly welcome discussion and discourse on all the topics that we talk about here on the podcast, and I hope that you'll find this conversation thought-provoking. And if nothing else, I hope you'll come away knowing whether or not you want to read the book. So without further ado, here's our interview. Welcome to the Sustainable Nano Podcast. On this episode, I'm happy to be here interviewing Peter Clement, did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Yes. Who is a first-year graduate student here at the University of Minnesota, which is also where I'm based. So we actually get to be in the same room talking to each other, which is nice. And Peter recently, or is in the process of writing a book review for our blog, our Sustainable Nano blog. And I asked him to come in and talk about this book for the podcast, kind of to get a chance to talk about some stuff that might not fit quite into the book review and kind of tell people if you recommend the book and why and what it's about. And so tell us a little bit about this book.
Sure. So it's the book is called The War on Science. It's by Sean Otto. And he is sort of looking at why there is a pushback against science in a lot of Western societies, but especially in the U.S., and why politically science is not a popular topic and why the advice of scientists is basically ignored in a lot of science policy. And so this book is a pretty cool little sociology delve into like how this movement arose and then, you know, on some level, what we as scientists and what the general public can do about that.
Yeah, so one thing that my first thought when I heard about this was like, uh-oh, are we getting into like politically touchy topics, but from the summary that you were telling me about, it sounds like that he's pretty kind of bipartisanly critical about political attitudes toward science. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, like, all parties are doing wrong. If you look at the Republicans, say they're opposing climate, you know, they deny that climate change is happening. If you look at both people in the Green Party and people in the Democratic Party, they basically, you know, insist that GMO foods be labeled, even though scientists basically consensus agree that, you know, these foods are not only not bad for us, but actually do a lot of good in the world. And so, yeah, it's sort of there's just, it is very common right now for politicians to use science and use the fact that they are opposed to science as a positive. And certain parties, certainly more than others, do this, but all parties are definitely guilty.
Mm-hmm. So. I wanted to get that off the right off the bat. Like, you know, we're definitely not trying to be a political message here, but the fact is that science is relevant to political decisions and to policy decisions, and to try to keep those separate is just not practical or doesn't help anything.
Right. I mean, one of the downsides of all the advances in science that we've made over the past century and the rapid advances in the last like 30 years are now we have the power to alter our planet on a level that we've never had before. And so we can do that for good or we can do that for bad. But on some level, I think there has to be a political discussion about that. And politicians need to be educated, or if not educated, then they need to be willing to listen to the scientific community and take their advice.
Right. Yeah. They don't have to be scientists themselves. And in fact, it sounds like Sean Otto is not a scientist by training, but
right.
has done the work to kind of understand how these things affect or are relevant to policy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So we were to keep things short, like I don't need to have to summarize the whole book or anything, but you were telling me that there's one particular element that you found interesting you wanted to talk about as far as like this sort of seven steps.
Yeah. So I'm a chemist, and I'm one of the reasons I've always been interested in chemistry, but one of the reasons I really wanted to study chemistry and pursue it is I got really interested when the BP oil spill happened in 2010. And there was, oil gushing into the Gulf of Mexico, and I was watching this happen, and I thought, okay, first of all, how did scientists and chemists and engineers let this happen? And second of all, why can't scientists and chemists and engineers fix this problem? Mm-hmm. And so I think one that sort of part of that is addressed in this book. So Mr. Otto goes through these seven stages of sort of scientific discovery and new technologies emerging. He calls them the seven stages of technical adaptation.
So did you like read through all seven, and then we can sort of talk a little bit about each one?
Sure. So he lists discovery, a new process or tool, for example, a chemical or today nanotechnology.
Hence our interest from the Center for Sustainable
or
Nanotechnology.
Genetic technology is discovered that vastly expands utility, power, convenience, or efficiency. Number two, application. Industrial applications are quickly developed and commercialized, often increasing productivity and lowering costs. But the science of biocomplexity and ecology of how the process or tool will affect and be affected by its broader context from the human body to the environment lags behind. So basically saying, we understand how to use this thing, but we don't really know what it's going to do once it's out there.
And I would say looking at this, like discovery and application seems like that's kind of the scope of what a lot of academic science focuses on.
Yeah.
Not 100% obviously, but we think about new discoveries and we think about talking about how are these new discoveries going to be applied.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still five more steps in this process. So
right.
That, takes beyond what we're accustomed to thinking about in
right.
kind of academic.
No, I completely agree. And I sort of see our center, and we can talk about this in
mm-hmm.
a little bit, but our center is sort of fitting in these two steps,
mm-hmm.
So the third step is development. Basically, industries grow this new application and invest a lot of money in this, and the use grows. The fourth, he calls boomerang. So this is a tipping point is reached at which the application has noticeable negative effects on health or the environment. So I think this is the other place that
mm-hmm.
academics come in. Is,
right.
You get an environmental scientist or a chemist who sees, hey, if we put this material into the environment, it's not so great. The fifth step is battle. So basically, regulations are proposed. Companies who have a lot of money invested throw their weight, fighting those regulations or any regulations that come up. And, they sort of cast any doubt possible that they can.
Mm-hmm.
The sixth stage is crisis. So basically, evidence builds to a point where you can no longer, there's just consensus on this. So becomes irrefutable, often through drastic or dramatic deaths or disasters. So we see that in things like climate disruption or, like we saw with the hole in the ozone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, you can unfortunately list a lot of examples
right.
of these crises
right.
of like the thalidomide birth defects and
right.
and eggshell damage after DDT use and yeah.
Yeah. Chemists do a lot of good, but we also sometimes don't do so good.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, though, that Otto is framing this as this is a process, not saying that, that new developments are inherently bad or that there's always, we should avoid them, but that
right.
this is a process that generally has to happen and that we have to try something, observe the consequences, and then step seven, I jumped ahead. But
right, no, and then adaptation, which is basically finally, regulations are passed or laws are passed to basically stop or modify the use of a material and to mitigate its effects. So, I think one of the things that interested me about this seven was it gave a framework to think about,
mm-hmm.
Environmental work and even work that we do in the center where we're trying to figure out, okay, what are potential ramifications of using
mm-hmm.
a material? And then maybe, just maybe we can
skip
a lot of these and just get straight to, skip some of the premature deaths and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff. So,
yeah. So the more we understand, if we can do more in the discovery application development part to try to anticipate potential downsides and adapt as we go and kind of short circuit this cycle.
Right. Right. So this is something that's repeated, for basically Sean Otto says since World War II and since there's sort of the science industry became much larger. You know, so this has been going on since like the 50s or late 40s. And, you know, if we can be responsible scientists and think through these things before they become issues, I think that would be the ideal place to be.
Mm-hmm. And this is, he came up with this sequence as an observational like thing, looking at all these examples of new technologies and how they get implemented and what happens sort of historically, he sees this pattern repeating itself.
Right. Yeah. And then he also notes sort of at the end of this section of the book, you know, he describes some of the same things that you were just talking about, Miriam, about DDT and a bunch of other things. And he also, you know, mentions that, you know, emerging battles over microbeads and other nanotech, you know, are going to be big issues that, you know, eventually we potentially could see these seven steps playing out. Mm-hmm. So,
and actually as we're recording this, we just recently had the new federal ban on some antibacterial substances in soaps that have been prevalent for a little while.
Right.
And you could argue that this, maybe you could debate whether we've reached true crisis point of antibacterial resistance, but maybe this is an attempt to
We see, you know, this process has been going on for long enough. I think scientists and people in general realize that there are issues and that we can, you know, skip some of these steps in terms of crisis, you know, and get out in front of it.
Yeah. So maybe that's a little success story. So talk a little more about how you see the, you know, your own research or like your approach to becoming a chemist, like how this affected kind of how you're thinking about your own career or within the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology more broadly.
Well, I think one of the reasons I was attracted to the center was because of, you know, potentially thinking about issues like this, right? Getting out ahead of things and, you know, preventing issues from arising. And just being, you know, we're doing really cool chemistry and we're developing cool materials and we're doing great stuff. And then we're also being very mindful of the effects of those things that we're doing. And I think that's, to me, there's chemistry in my philosophy behind it. It has to be somewhat holistic. You have to think about the impacts of what you're making and think about down the line, what is this going to do? And I think that was definitely one of the reasons that I decided when applying to PhD program that being in a group that was in the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology was something I really wanted. So.
Awesome. Cool. Well, we're trying to keep this short and sweet, but what's your kind of final word on review of the book, recommendation? Who do you think would enjoy or be interested in reading this book?
I think there are, if you are at all frustrated with the inability of politicians or the refusal of politicians to, you know, listen to scientists, even when there's clear consensus. So whether you're a scientist and you feel that, you know, your voice isn't being heard, or whether you're a member of the general public and you feel that scientists should get more respect in politics, then, you know, I think this is definitely a great book to pick up, and I would definitely recommend it. So it's part history, part, you know, sociology or something, and then part motivating movement for scientists and those who care about science and seeing science, you know, be restored to its rightful place, I guess. So. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, yeah, this definitely makes me curious to read it, so I'll check it out. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking on the podcast today.
All right. Thanks for listening to our first ever Sustainable Nano podcast book review. Stay tuned for future episodes where I'm hoping that we get to talk about Hope Jaron's memoir, Lab Girl, and the recent book about the microbiome called I Contain Multitudes by Ed Yong, among many others. If you have suggestions for other books that we should be reading or comments on this or other episodes of the podcast, please let us know. You can find us at our website, sustainable-nano.com/podcast, or on Twitter, Facebook, or Pinterest at Sustainable Nano. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and we're also proud to be available on Science 360 Radio. It's Thanksgiving week here in the U.S., and I just want to say that I am so thankful to be part of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which is the amazing producer of this podcast. And I'm thankful in turn that the Center is funded by the National Science Foundation. The Center is really extraordinary for being a group of genuinely lovely people as well as excellent scientists, and it is a delight to get to work with them every day. If you want to know more about the work of the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, you can check out our blog at sustainable-nano.com or the CSN website at susnano.wisc.edu. Those links and lots of other relevant information will all be in the show notes for today's episode, and you can find that at sustainable-nano.com/podcast. Okay, that's it for this episode. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.